Shares. Market. The S&P. The ASX. Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, well, may or may not have a deal. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you?
G'day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, I'm very, very well. We might have a deal. Now, I'm not talking about the Channel 7 show at 5:30 on weeknights. I'm talking about a big, big deal. We may just have a deal on Brexit. Or not, by the time you hear this podcast. But at the moment, it looks like it might possibly happen. We'll talk about that this week, mate. We'll also talk about my drive, push, badgering people to get a better rate. There's a hashtag that goes with it. Stay tuned for that one. The latest attack of the short sellers. WiseTech is now on the block. But is it fact or fiction? We'll have a look at that one. We'll look at the Latitude IPO, which got pulled. Are we looking at WeWork 2.0 or something else going on? Mate, get excited. I'm getting on my high horse. It's going to happen. You pumped?
More high horse.
More high horse. And we will dip, as always, into the full mailbag. Let's get on with it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, the news overnight is that Boris Johnson and his counterparts in the EU may finally, possibly, depending on who you believe and what detail you look at, have a deal on Brexit. Now, we're not necessarily Brexit experts here, nor are we particularly keen on the geopolitics angle. But I am curious as to how you're expecting that potential bit of news or the bit of potential news. This, of course, could be a trade deal in the sort of China and the US that have been allegedly having trade deals for, I think, about 6 months so far. But assuming this happens, what does it mean, if anything, for investors in Australia?
First of all, I'll just say that, it's like the cry wolf situation, right? There's been so much cry wolf that I don't know which news to believe. So, even if it comes from the horse's mouth, I mean, it's hard to believe. In this particular case, at least, it looks like the EU and the government of the UK have come to an agreement.
Right.
But my understanding is that the deal needs approval from the British Parliament. Now, if it doesn't get approval for British Parliament for whatever reason, then there might not be any deal. So there's a little wrinkle there. In terms of investing, I mean, some of our financial services companies, for example, have UK exposure. I think consumer businesses that have exposure, it's not a big deal. Mm. But for the financial services businesses, there's exposure to UK, there's been a bit of uncertainty there. Some certainty there would help. But overall, for Aussie investors on the ASX, I mean, I think the overall impact, I would say it's small. It's not a big deal. But there are companies like, for example, Bravura, Premium, which, you know, operate in sort of the fintech space that have exposure to the UK. And for them, I think this is good news.
Mm. It's a funny one. I mean, to some degree too, whether there's a deal or not on Brexit is kind of one question. The other question we don't yet know the answer to is, what does the deal actually mean for England in particular, for Britain in particular? Coming out of Europe is still the question we haven't answered yet, right? So to some degree, this deal is a deal to make it happen. We don't yet quite know what happens when it happens, if that makes sense. We don't really know yet. You know, does the UK pulling out of the EU, is it a non-event? I mean, it's very possible it ends up being one of those non-event kind of outcomes, because both groups find a way to effectively make it business as usual for all intents and purposes. Of course, on the flip side, maybe this is a horrible thing, and we do see, you know, meaningful economic slump in Britain as Europe basically turns inward and moves away from the UK. There'll be some, I'm sure, in the EU Parliament or EU bureaucracy who want to see Britain pay in some way, shape or form for pulling out. That's the thing I guess we don't yet know, right? So the fact that a deal is being done to make it happen is only really the first cab off the rank. I think there's still a little bit to play out.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. There's a little bit of play out there. There's some wrinkle around how Northern Ireland, for example, is going to be, which basically is, you know, how Ireland is going to actually be a part of the deal, and how, you know, how they're going to deal with Ireland versus the rest of the
This is fascinating,
Europe,
right?
So that's the fascinating part.
Northern Ireland kind of goes into the European Customs Union under the proposed deal, and they're going to have to put some sort of customs border between the UK and Northern Ireland when basically, and I don't want to oversimplify this, and I'm not an expert in geopolitics, but effectively the whole deal about, you know, the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, has been exactly that. Are they part of the UK or not? Where do we put the borders in? How does that this work? I mean, it's almost a step towards the reunification of Ireland in some way, shape or form, which allegedly the Unionist Party in Ireland are not going to vote for, as you said.
Yes.
So this may still fall over. I guess having a deal, as you say, on paper with the EU is one thing. Whether Johnson can deliver on that deal is another. Excuse me. And then again, whether we end up with some sort of outcome that works or not is probably a third question we still have to answer. So fair to say a little bit more detail required before we know what happens next.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
All right. Well, and look, for those who listen to us regularly, you'll know our next answer. I guess, though, mate, for better or worse, other than those companies that are specifically involved, and I guess you are, we are kind of obliged to have a view on Brexit if one of our companies has meaningful business in the UK or Europe, right? Like at some level, we can say we don't know, and that's okay too, but you can't really say, well, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But for most of us who are investing in companies that aren't in the UK or Europe in big, big ways, if you have an Australian portfolio or a US portfolio where that it just doesn't make that much difference, I think we'd probably still say, look, for all of the bluster and all the headlines, we're still better off most of us effectively ignoring it, because it's one of those these two shall pass kind of moments, right? If I own shares in Woolworths in Australia or Telstra, which I happen to do, by the way, at Google or an Amazon, and again, I own shares in both, you own shares in Amazon, these disclaimers are getting long, it doesn't really matter, right, for those companies. It may well add volatility, but we shouldn't really be, spending any time really thinking about it in any detail unless our businesses have decent exposure, export exposure, or on the ground exposure in one of those jurisdictions.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the main, as I said, for financial businesses, there were concerns about how transactions across the right. UK and the transactions that are between the UK and Europe are going to be managed.
Right.
So those I think were the issues. But yeah, I feel like if your business, which is consumer focused, which has even got UK exposure, Europe exposure, really is, I think, a non-event in that sense. I mean, such events keep happening. Like, you know, there are larger geopolitical issues here. Like, you know, does this mean it becomes easier to get out of the European Union? What does it mean for the European Union? If slowly people start bleeding out of the European Union, is it really a problem? It's probably not. It just depends, right? So, yeah, I mean. Yeah. I wouldn't fret too much about it, except, as I said, for businesses that are in the fintech space with specific exposure, with a decent business exposed to the UK.
Nice. Let's move on, shall we, mate? I'm going to talk about something. One of my favorite hobby horses, not the high horse, just a hobby horse. Stand by.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. I've banged on about this many, many, many times. I'm going to bang on about it many, many more times because, frankly, I don't know there's much more we can do for most people in terms of making them richer. So if you want to get richer, you got to start listening right now. For the next couple of minutes, start listening right now. I have a favorite hashtag on Twitter. It's my favorite hashtag because I made it up. And unfortunately, no one else yet has has caught on. I'm sure they're about to. I'm absolutely sure they're about
to.
So.
Haven't you asked the banks to to adopt?
Funnily enough, they haven't done that, mate. So my hashtag is hashtag get a better rate. It's pretty much what it says on the tin. I've been ranting for a very long time. Look, we will drive across town to save a couple of cents on petrol. Or many of us will. I don't personally, but some of us will. You don't because you've got a Tesla, which is a whole different question.
I drive for free. I'll drive across town for free electricity.
You would do that. This is true. we do that. And we try, we want to save, 84 cents on a pack of Arnott Shapes at Woolies, or we'll buy an extra, 24-pack of Coke because it's on special. We do a lot to save some money. The lack of any effort whatsoever most people go to save money on their mortgage is absolutely astounding. When you think it could literally be costing you up to six figures, you could buy a Tesla and a half, right? For the amount of money some people could save on their mortgages by literally making 20-minute phone call to their banks. And it drives me absolutely spare. Now, if you're listening to this right now, you've heard this before, and you're like, dude, I've already done it. I've done it twice. I know I'm getting the best rate. Then fantastic. Good on you. You get to go and stop listening for the next 60, 90 seconds. Go and make yourself a cuppa or grab a beer if this is after hours. Come back because we'll still be talking. For those who haven't, unless you know you're getting the lowest rate in the market, why you wouldn't be calling your bank every 3 months, every 6 months saying, hey, I see so-and-so over there has got a better rate than you guys have. What are you going to do to keep me? And for most people, there is a decent saving. If they say nothing, you've wasted 20 minutes, right? Now, that's not much fun, but it's hardly a problem. If they give you a reduction of 0.1, 0.2, 0.3%, there's tens of thousands of dollars. If you don't want tens of thousands of dollars, give it to me. If you honestly have that much cash, you don't care how much you're paying on your mortgage, give it to me, please. Now, I'm bringing up only, well, two reasons. One is because I generally like to rant about this stuff. The second is I want to give a rap to Peter Sullivan on Twitter. Now, Peter hit me up during the week. He said, "Hi, Scott, just spent 20 minutes on the phone with ING and had our variable rate reduced by," here's a dramatic pause, "1.06%. Wasn't that 20 minutes well spent? Thanks for the steer, Peter." 1%.
That's 1%. Pretty massive. That's massive, actually.
I don't
actually.
Know Peter's circumstance. I don't know how old he is, how long he's paying off his loan at, what his mortgage is. If Peter's not going to save 100 grand out of this, I'd be bloody surprised, just on the law of averages, right? Now, maybe he's not. Maybe he's in the 29th year of a $200,000 mortgage, and that's great. If he's anywhere near the first third of his mortgage and he's borrowing anywhere near the average loan, the amount of money you pay in interest over that period, I would, again, I can't guarantee anything. I don't want to make any sort of false claims. But as I said, if Peter's not saving six figures, I'd be bloody surprised. And if most of our listeners can't save something similar, half that, a quarter of that. Mm. If you don't save 20 grand, again, give it to me. If you, honestly, you are that well off, you don't care. If you can save 30, 40, 50, what if you could save 60 or 80 grand listening to this right now and you don't do anything after this podcast? I will be absolutely staggered. So please, for the love of God, you listen to us for great investment advice that hopefully builds your wealth. That's wonderful. You buy a cheap Coke when it's on special at Woolies, fantastic. Please, please go and get a better rate. Hashtag get a better rate. Hit us up on the Twitters, hit us up on Instagram, hit us up on Facebook. Let us know your get a better rate story. You'll feel good about yourself. You get to do a little bit of showing off, and hopefully you'll motivate some of your fellow listeners and readers to do the same thing yourself.
You know, when you do that on Twitter, maybe you should use the hashtag. Well, I'm telling our listeners,
nice.
Use get a better rate hashtag. And maybe hashtag the bank that actually also or add the rate to the bank that actually gave you a better, you know, better deal.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right? So you give them, you know, talk them up, and mm-hmm. maybe, you know, if you want to be really nasty, you can talk down the bank that didn't give you a better deal.
I am fascinated. I mean, look, human incentives or human behavior is just so fascinating, right? We talk about it a lot with investing. The things that we do or don't do investing wise because of our unevolved brains or our partially evolved brains, and I don't say that as critical. You and I have the same brain as anyone else listening. We're not saying they're bad. We're saying we're as bad. Our brains simply haven't caught up with modern finance. We just can't do those things instinctively. We can run away from lions. We can climb trees. Well, some of us can climb trees. I can't climb trees. You know, we can do things that we kind of, you know, evolved to do well. We haven't evolved to do our finances well. We just haven't had that change in our evolutionary biology, right? And so that's just fascinating. But our laziness, our lack of kind of drive and interest when it comes to how much we're paying on bank fees, on interest, on... If we had a straw poll, people, their credit card fees, it's maybe get a better rate. If I asked 15 people on the street, I guarantee you nobody would know exactly what their credit card interest rate is. They might know kind of roughly. They might know kind of roughly their annual fee they're paying. But again, you know, it's great for the banks because they get to do this stuff. We don't actually see it, right? If you had to pay every month a payment of your principal, and then a separate payment of interest, and they had to say, this cost me this much because this is your interest rate, and it would cost this much less if you had a lower rate, we'd all go and change, or at least a lot of us would. But it's one lump sum, and it's a large amount anyway, and we kind of don't think we can do anything about it. And so we kind of just forget about it, right? And it's the single largest, I think, impact you can have, guaranteed return you can get, is simply go to your bank and get a better rate. Shall I move on?
Let's move on.
That's not even the high horse, dude.
This almost sounds like the high horse.
Episode, isn't it?
Yo, this is sounding like the high horse already.
So the next topic, that's where the high horse comes in.
Okay.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, so this week, in fact, only on, was it Thursday afternoon?
Yesterday, yeah.
So we're recording this on Friday morning in the sunny surrounds of the Southern Highlands, by the way. If this sounds a little bit different, don't blame the techs at MMM. Blame us because we're recording this at my place in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. So yesterday afternoon, WiseTech was hit by one of the infamous and frankly dreaded short selling reports that seem to drop on our market every month or so over the last year. This time, as I said, it was WiseTech. It was a company called J Capital, the letter J, J Capital, who are alleging, among other things, some issues with what they call revenue recognition. In other words, when you get to count the sales, that's a kind of a big deal. They're questioning the way that the auditing has been done by the accountants, or the auditors, I should say, in terms of individual subsidiaries around the world. They're also, this is, I think, a first for me in a major short case. alleging that WiseTech are actually, alleging is probably the right word, are making up revenue, but also, which was bizarre, making up expenses. Now, lots and lots of stuff around this. Is a very, very thick report. Lots of graphs, lots of allegations. A photo of a small car with a WiseTech logo in their car park, which I think is probably just a short seller. You need to show you actually did some sort of on the ground research. So you show a car with a logo outside headquarters and say, "See, we've been there. We've done the work. We've put it in the boot leather." Mate, that all that notwithstanding, the shares fell 10% yesterday afternoon before the shares were paused and then subsequently halted until this coming Monday. Now, if you're listening to this podcast after Monday morning, you'll know what comes next. We don't yet. It's still only Friday morning here. The shares are still halted. And unfortunately for the poor buggers at WiseTech, they're not going to get to see their families this weekend, mate. They'll be stuck in the office. The entire finance team has been called in. The sales and marketing team probably, or the head of those team have been called in. There'll be teleconference calls. There'll be lawyers' fees. There'll be all sorts of stuff going on at WiseTech headquarters. The midnight oil will certainly be burning. Question though, mate. Is this legitimate? I mean, is this... I've talked about short sellers, and I will again in a minute. They have been known, some of them, allegedly, to just be simply stirring up trouble of highly valued stocks, trying to create enough fear to profit. And frankly, that's a very evil but very profitable path. If you can find a stock that you can scare people out of, it sends the share price down 20, 30, 40%, and then you get to close your short position, you can make a lot of money doing that, even if there's no legitimacy to the claims. Now, in other cases... Enron, most notably, I suppose, if we want to go all the way back then, that was a very, very well-founded short case, which was absolutely on the money. And so that's what people think about, I think, is when you hear a short thesis, you think, well, what if this is an entire fraud? What if this company is worth a whole lot less? Maybe I should sell my shares. That's why the shares crashed yesterday afternoon before they were halted. What comes next?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, for disclosure purposes, you know, WiseTech is a recommendation in one of the services we run, Motley Fool Pro.
Correct.
I'll start by saying one thing. So,
let me add quickly, though, mate, just to be very, very clear, not as a recommendation, we actually own as a company
because
we backed that portfolio with originally $1 million of our own cash, mm-hmm. worth a lot more now due to the good work of you and your team, mate. So, well done. But the WiseTech position, we do own some shares as a company as well as it being a recommendation.
That's correct. Yeah. So, we have our members following it, and we also own the stock in as recommended in terms of the allocation and so on in the portfolio.
Right.
Yeah. So, we have skin in the game. So I read the report as soon as it came out, as you'd expect.
Yes.
And here's the first thing I'll say. You know, so if somebody goes to the J Capital website, and mm-hmm. I'll paraphrase this, the first thing after you say, you know, you could say you're Australian or you're not Australian. It depends on that, what you land up saying. You know, I actually went there, and the first thing they say on the website, which I actually would applaud, is said, we are biased.
Yeah, that's right.
We are short sellers. We are biased. Yeah, yeah. And... we do our research, but we could be wrong. And, you know, we benefit when the stock falls. So this is the number. So the short sellers, basically, they would borrow shares from others, sell them in the market. You know, they've got cash now in their bank, and their hope is the shares are going to go down so that they can buy the shares later on the market and return it to the rightful owners of the shares, right?
Right, right.
Why do the owners give the shares away? Because they get to make some interest on that, you know, on the shares that other people are borrowing. So there's, mm-hmm. you know, there's financial transaction where people are making money here. So that's number one thing to do. Now, I don't mean to say that, you know, these guys are fabricating stuff. They should, you know, they must believe what they're saying, mm-hmm. and they've done. Now, the problem I have here is this. One of the things to remember is it is very hard as an outsider to, you know, you could claim that there is revenue recognition problems here,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, it's an audited account, right? And it's an audited account, and I mean, if you don't believe that, then you know, you're basically making extrapolations here, right? And you know, you have to believe that extrapolation is correct to make the claim.
Right,
now,
right.
Does that mean that it doesn't happen? It of course happens, right?
Yeah.
Has it happened in this case? We really don't know.
Right.
And I'd rather wait for the rebuttal, I guess, from the company to come. That's number one. I'll say that. Number two is, you know, one of the things that what they point out was, well, this company was unspectacular for most of its pre-public life.
Mm-hmm.
It came on with small amounts of revenue, and the revenue has, you know, grown rapidly since then.
How does that happen? By the way.
That's all true. How did that happen? Well, you know, sometimes it does happen.
Right.
that a company has an unspectacular life. And I know a couple, I know actually a few others that have had unspectacular first 20 years, you know, and then things happen. And, you know, the reason I'd say things happen is, you know, 20 years ago, there was no, the internet was not as widespread.
Right.
20 years ago, we did not use internet-based technology and the cloud as much as we use today.
Right.
Really, the cloud has taken off in the last, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years. And it's, you know, and many industries, especially logistics industries, for example, I would assume would be late adopters of this sort of technology. So there could be genuine reasons why the revenue has actually taken off at a much later stage. Right now we have cloud accounting. Well, do you really have cloud accounting, you know, 10, 15 years ago, right? So I think that it's a little bit of a, I mean, the comment is correct, but there's always a rebuttal that's possible, right? And that's, I think, the problem with any of these things is that, you know, there's a rebuttal possible for everything. What do you believe? You know, honestly, I think the thing to realize here, this is a pretty large company, and one could say that the valuation is on the higher side. That definitely then means that, you know, it is likely to attract attention from various types of people, because I mean, you know, if you think that there are issues and it's high valuation, then, you know, there's a chance that, you know, the shares can move actually down.
Yeah, I think that's right. If I was either cynically or even legitimately looking for a short case where I believed that the raising of either made up claims or real claims, but in a way that could actually have an outsized impact on the share price, and those are both real things. You know, I don't like short sellers. I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, if I'm a legitimate short seller who just simply likes that as a way of making money, and I'm allowed to do it, then nothing wrong with that, legally at least. And if I can find a company I believe is probably doing the wrong thing, but also I can add in the fact that, hey, there's a high valuation. In other words, there's a lot of downside, frankly, between, you know, an optimistic valuation, something more reasonable, if I can create some doubt. If I'm looking for a business and I want to say, well, if I can find one that has a revenue recognition issue. Now, revenue recognition is an accounting term. If I go to a shop, pay with cash, and they give me the product, that's both the cash they get and the revenue at the same time. If I, though, was to take out a subscription with a cloud accounting provider, as you say, Doctor, use your example, and I take it out today, well, they have to recognize that revenue over 12 months. If I was to engage someone to do a whole lot of work for me that required a whole lot of upfront costs and then some revenue, well, then do I recognize the revenue all upfront because that's when the work was done, down the track over the life of the subscription? There are many, many ways the accounts are allowed, literally, legally, ethically, morally, under the accounting standards, allowed to be recognized. And so if I can do that, I can sort of make some claims or raise some doubts, then that's an issue. And then if I add on top of that, I looked at the list. I must say, mate, I was pretty impressed amazed by the number of acquisitions WiseTech has done. And they did claim that as, again, one of the problems. Now, is it a real problem or is it simply raising enough doubt to muddy the waters? We don't yet know. I want to say 20 plus. I didn't count it, but I imagine 20-odd companies since listing they've acquired over the life of their life as a public company. And so M&A acquisition kind of accounting, what's organic, what's acquired growth, that kind of stuff. Again, really easy to potentially, if you're a dodgy company, really easy to cover your tracks and make up stuff. If you're a dodgy short seller, really easy to claim that could be made up stuff that's covering your tracks. And if you're somewhere in between, then as an investor, you're left wondering what comes next. And I think, to my mind, that there are, legitimate or not, even if the short case is right, in terms of they're right about their claims, there are some companies that's easy to make those claims about and to profit more from because they have certain characteristics that simply make it harder to defend against a short report like this one.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, you know, one of the things is that revenue recognition, there are many ways, as you exactly said, right? And the acquisitions, I mean, WiseTech is an acquisitive company.
Yes.
Has acquired a lot of things. Now, most of the acquisitions are actually relatively small, right? So they acquired, you know, it's more like a tech type of acquisition. It's an acqui-hire. So you basically hire a bunch of people, you get their tech, you integrate it into your platform, and then, you know, it sort of expands your reach in that sense.
Yep,
and then,
sense.
You know, you can do a bit of a land and expand type of strategy where you've landed a bunch of clients now, but they can be now moved to a bigger platform and they could be sold more things, right? So, so it's, again, as you said, those are the laundry list of things. Another thing I'd point this out, and I think this is important for people to realize, largely because the pain of loss is so much higher than the pain, you know, the joy of gain, right?
Right, right.
So people are going to react. People's first reaction is, let me run for the hills, right?
Yes,
so that's why, you know, the moment the report comes out, the stock falls because people are just running for the hills. That's number one.
Right.
Number two, I think is like, I mean, yes, as long as we profit from the stock going up. So in a way, we have a vested interest in the stock going up. They have a vested interest in the stock going down.
Right.
It's relatively equivalent, right? The thing to keep in mind, though, is what is the track record of the short seller? Now, like the Enron is a good example, right? I mean, you know, somebody could become famous for one short case. What is their track record overall as a short seller?
Right.
It's really material to me because, you know, I mean, you know, are they just short sellers because that's what they think they can do well?
Yeah.
But have they actually, you know, found enough shorts that are legitimate?
Right, this is, and you're a scientist, right? And you get this, I know. And this has always been my issue with the likes of the Dr. Dooms and the kind of the people who are alleged to have foreseen the GFC or foreseen whatever big catastrophe is going to happen is you can, you know, there is no scientist in the world who would say, oh, you did that once.
Yeah.
I should listen to you forever after that, right?
Exactly.
The chance that's a coin toss or worse is really, really high. Do it three times. You're still not going to believe them. Do it a dozen times. You're going to start to say, okay, maybe you're worth listening to. And so for all of the – and look, the media make it worse. On one hand, I blame them outright. The other hand, I don't blame them at all because all they can do is report what happened and whatever. And as humans, we're the ones who are drawing the conclusions, the parallels. But at some point, you've got to say, as you rightly said, even if they were right once or if they were wrong once – frankly, we shouldn't be imputing any greater or less expectation on their next decision. In fact, there's probably a mean reversion which says if you know whatever you did last time, you're probably likely to be the opposite next time just because these things actually average out rather than actually compounding.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, you know, like the Enron one, as I said, is a famous one, right? But you know, you found Enron once. Does you know how many others have you found? Is the question I would ask. That's
right.
Number one. Is it statistically valid, significant, and so on? Is the other thing I'd valid? You know, I wouldn't blame media per se, right? I mean, media is looking for headlines. They want clicks to happen. They
right.
need news. So I mean. They're basically doing their job, right?
Right.
They're reporting. The other thing to keep in mind is a so-called hedge fund can set up shop. They can close shop, then set up shop on another name. I know that many such instances have happened in the past,
okay.
right? Because, you know, well, that didn't work out. So you close shop and you move on to, you know, you start another shop with another brand and then you again go short. So we can, like all of those things said, I am open-minded to the fact that yes, frauds do happen.
Yep.
They, you know, and even if we say that the auditors, I mean, the audit, you know, again, it's like it's the case is that the auditors have done their job. Let's say they've done the best possible job, and I'm saying that they have done that. Even then, they can miss stuff because
of
various laws, various regulations, various ways in which, you know, after all, auditors are depending on, you know, management's interpretation of, you know, how the accounts are working and how the revenue is flowing and so on. So there's a lot of ways in which things can go wrong. So, I think we need to keep an open mind whenever there's a short report, and we need to see what the company says in response to that. But, you know, running for the hills at the first instance is probably a very, like, you know, it's a very Saharan, you know, sub-Saharan 5,000 year ago type of reaction.
On the savannah, yeah.
Yeah, it's all, on the savannah, I shouldn't say Saharan. You know, on the savannah because, you know, the lion is going to kill you.
Right. You don't mind being wrong a couple of times if it means you save yourself from getting eaten, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, in this case, I think, you know, if anybody has got a position which is not superly oversized, right? I mean, you're not really going to be eaten by whatever happens. And if that's the case, then, you know, you need to be patient and think through these things. So, that's our intention.
Mate, I'm going to move straight from there to my rant, my high horse. You've taken some of my thunder, which is probably good news for our listeners. Bad news for me because I like to rant. Makes me happy. I've ranted about short sellers before. I'm not even going to rant about short sellers directly this time because people know my view, and I would ban short selling outright if I was given the choice. And that is not because I'm a long and they're short, and therefore, you know, I'm trying to remove competition, although it would probably help me at least in some cases. I would do it because of exactly what you said, Doc, which is the way we respond to good and bad news. Not only do we feel pain three times as much as we feel an equivalent gain, but compounding that, we're more likely to panic more, therefore making that absolute size of that loss even bigger and then feeling it three times as bad. So, you know, the idea of feeling gain or pain three times as much as we enjoy the gain of the same amount. If you lose 5% with your shares and you gain 5%, that 5% you lose feels three times as bad, even though the numbers are the same. And the more rational our listeners will say, but it's the same. I would feel the same. You know what? You think you would, and maybe even you as an individual listener do, but the, every other one of your listeners, our listeners, I promise you, feel the pain of a 5% loss more than they enjoy the gain of a 5% winner, right? A 5% gain. That's one thing. Add to that, though, the compounding factor that if you have a short thesis and a long thesis side by side, you are going to, or investors generally, we know this from experience, there's millions of them, GetSwift, Corporate Travel Management, which I own and we've recommended, WiseTech most recently, what else have I missed, Doc?
There's Blue Sky, those have like, you know...
Rural funds.
Rural funds.
When they happen, so the same long and short case side by side, they can never actually be the same, but you know,
RFG
long and short
case also, side by side. Also short.
Yep. You know, if I release a report that says, guess what? I think WiseTech is great. The shares will go up maybe nothing, maybe the four, maybe got 0.5%. Someone who doesn't even have a reputation says, I think WiseTech is bad and here's why. The shares will fall 10 and in theory on Monday morning, unless they have a really good rebuttal, probably further. The reality is we simply respond more instinctively, more aggressively, more over the top to those cases. So not only do we feel the pain three times as much, the pain is actually bigger because it literally is, you know, a share price might go up a little bit on a bull case report and a share price that gets smashed on a bear case report, and then we feel that worse, that kind of compounds that pain. So they're the issues I have with short selling. What I want to talk about a little bit was just not so much a high horse, but more a warning for our listeners as we kind of proceed from the WiseTech situation, whichever way this pans out. So it's not so much a high horse as a warning. Just be mindful that because you know now, because I've just ranted about it, because we've just talked about it, Doc was more eloquent and thoughtful, I've just ranted. The reality is there's going to be another short case. There are other short sellers out there right now, legitimate or otherwise, looking at the ASX and trying to work out which company they can target next with a report like J Capital's to try and profit from a share price falling. Now, if you own a stock that is irregular, so if you've got a stock that is particularly highly priced, if it has a particularly messy mergers and acquisitions background, if it has a particularly unusual way of recognizing revenue, if it simply doesn't fit the mold, and again, I'm talking about, say, Rural Funds Group, right? They had a collection of, frankly, individual assets that couldn't easily be compared side by side. If you own office buildings and a certain amount of rent in a certain location, there's going to be one up the road, down the road, across the street. You can pretty much line them up two by two and say, right, it's this big, it's this size, this is the value of it, here's the rent, that makes sense. If you own a group of properties that can't easily be valued on the market because you've got a 1,000-hectare place here and a 15,000-hectare place on the other side of the country with beef cattle rather than sheep, or with, you know, wine grapes rather than wheat, you know, those things are incredibly hard to objectively, externally value. And so guess what? If you're trying to create doubt, if you're trying to raise some concerns, you're going to go after those companies that don't easily fit those molds. Now, the problem with that is that when they're successful, those are the companies that actually do deliver really, really strong results. And so this is kind of one of those strong stomach situations. People went short for Amazon on Amazon many, many, many times over multiple decades. People have been going short and long Tesla similarly in recent years. Now, in the fullness of time, we'll know which one of those do well or badly, or maybe they both do well, both do badly. That won't be the question. The reality is, if you've got a situation where you've got something that's unusual, something that's irregular, very, very, very easy for a short seller to target it because it's easy to raise doubts and concerns. Now, I can imagine a scenario in 1975, to pick a year, where Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway may well have been shorted because, well, who's this guy from the Midwest of Omaha who does this stuff that no one else is doing, and somehow he's making all this money and he may be just inventing profits. And I could write a pretty strong short case just based on, we don't think it's possible that an investor could achieve these sorts of returns. We think that these sorts of companies he's buying can't possibly be worth this much money. How is it possible an insurance company can own publicly listed assets and do well? You could write a fantastic short case. And was it true? No, but I could raise a whole lot of doubt, right? Now, if that was only 1975, 1985, 1995, you could make a pretty good bear case for Berkshire Hathaway. Now, we know 40 years later, that would have been, even if it did happen and the share price was volatile, a profitable investment to continue to hold. And so my warning for our listeners, Doc, is that be prepared for short cases. You need to know it's going to happen. If you're investing in any sort of growth company, any company's doing anything differently, it has ambitions. You know, Steve Jobs said, you know, what is it? Here's to the crazy ones. The crazy ones, the ones that get called out, right? Because it's easy to create doubt. It's easy to wonder if maybe they're getting it wrong. Now, sometimes they will be getting it wrong, by the way. So we're not saying arbitrarily you should always invest in these companies, they will always win. What we're saying is just be mindful that it will happen. And so as an investor, if you're not ready for that yet, please get yourself ready for it. Because if you don't own WiseTech shares, your company may or may not be next. Now, raises the question, Doc, I suppose, as I finish my rant, just come down slowly off my elevated level here, my stand, my soapbox. Does that mean we should avoid or ignore companies that may get shorted?
No, I think you should invest in companies that you believe have bright futures.
But if I had avoided WiseTech on Wednesday, I could have avoided a 10% fall. Surely if I just never bought it, I'd be better off, wouldn't I?
Yeah, only if you knew it's going to be shorted, right? I mean, the problem is this, you know, is a company going to become a 10-bagger? You don't know.
Right.
Is a company going to be shorted? You don't know. I mean, right. the fundamental thing about investing is that there is a lot of don't knows involved, and you just have to acknowledge that there's a lot. Anybody who says that I know everything, it's basically to me actually that's my starting point. Is anybody says, okay, I know this and this is true.
Yeah.
I said, well, I think I'm just going to call BS on that.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's the number one thing. Mate. So I think that, you know, you just got to realize as longs too, not all the calls are going to work out. As shorts, not all the calls are going to work out.
Yep.
And you just need to make sure that overall the calls work out for you. And you know, that's the beauty of investing, is that if you get overall things right,
yeah,
it'll work out fine in the fullness of time. You can't make money right now. You make money over a period of time. And I think that's the thing that I think most people don't realize. It's just, you just need to give time to do its magic.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, mate. I think, you know, I've used the example a million times. I'm going to keep using it because it's useful. I pick Amazon, and we know that's some degree survivorship bias, and I'm just picking a stock that I can justify it. So I'm not suggesting this is necessarily always the case or even mostly the case, but Amazon went from, I want to say, 3 to 100 and back to 9, if I'm right.
Yeah.
So I mean, 30 times your money. And then someone said, oh, short Amazon $100. And it goes back to 9. They say, see, I told you I was right. Now, for anyone who's followed it, and again, we both own shares, Amazon went from $9 to now the close enough to $1,800.
Well, at one point it was $2,000.
There you go. Right. So 800-ish now, I think.
It's something like that.
Whatever it is. Yeah. Anyway, you know, missing out that 18-bagger, the 18 times gain, because, no more than that, was it?
Well, if it was 90, it's
the zero off that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like 20-bagger.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that sort of gain, you know, you want to be, no, it's 200-bagger.
Was it from 30 to 9? Was it, or 9 to 9?
So it was 3 to 100, then back to 9, then up to 1,800. So yeah, 200-bagger.
Yeah.
You know, you've missed that because the shorters were, air quotes, right. Again, that's a stock that would have been really easy to get pushed out of the excitement, pushed out of the concern, pushed out of the whatever at that point. Now, if we knew what Amazon was going to do, of course you'd hold the shares. You didn't know that at the time, but that's kind of the point, right? So yes, you could avoid almost all of these short cases by simply investing in the small, boring, lowly valued, you know, it's really easy to avoid that. No one's going to be shorting the, or at least not with any impact. There's no, you know, none of these big, fancy kind of scary short reports. There are people shorting all stocks all the time, you know, banks and everything else. But, you know, a big scary short report is not going to do it. If you want to avoid those, you simply avoid anyone doing anything different or new or original or growing at decent rates and frankly worth a lot. You could do that. I dare say if you avoided every possible short candidate, you'd be much worse off than buying them and occasionally getting one that goes against you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is so true.
Let's move on.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, is it WeWork 2.0? Latitude, the Australian financial company, the fifth largest lender in the country. I had no idea. I don't know where I was, under a rock, I think. So you think about large lenders, you think, okay, the big four banks, and then you go, okay, well, then there's Suncorp and Bendigo and Adelaide Bank and Bank of Queensland, and you kind of do the list, and then someone says, actually, no, the fifth biggest lender, so the basically the next one after the big four, is Latitude, a private company, still now private, as it turns out, who wanted to get themselves onto the ASX, make a bit of money for the private equity holders, a bit of money for the boss, ex-NAB executive Ahmed Fahour. It didn't go ahead. Mm-hmm. And it didn't go ahead even after they'd cut the asking price by 20%. Now, it's probably an unfair line to draw, but WeWork's IPO got pulled not that long ago. The company that rented office space, then kind of subdivided it up and then re-rented it or re-leased it to tenants at higher prices, sold itself as a software company somehow. That's a whole different story. I don't think Latitude's exactly in that class. But we've still seen two large IPOs, one in the US and one in Australia, now pulled from the market, potentially for an extended period of time. What's going on? Is there something in IPO land? Is there something in finance land? Was there something specific to Latitude? Where do you come down on the question of why Latitude didn't quite make it to the ASX?
Yeah, so the Latitude is an interesting case because, I mean, the guidance price at which they wanted to, or the offer price range, I guess, at which they were trying to have the IPO was going to price it at, what, 12 times profit.
Yep.
Now, That seems pretty reasonable.
Well, yeah. I mean, you think about sort of bank, lower than the average market IPO, market PE, I should say, and it's a little bit, oh, maybe it's bang on roughly what the banks are selling for now. I mean, it's not exactly an outlandish price to ask for.
Yeah, well, the banks, I think, are, like the Commonwealth Bank and stuff are like 15, 16 times, I would think, earnings.
So net, as a kind of a guy who doesn't mind looking at value occasionally, I'm thinking, well, Latitude seems interesting, at least at this point.
Yeah, no, but I think, you know, I think what people were asking for was more discount to the offer price to take on the risk. I think the interesting point here was that it's hard to know. Well, the news was that it's oversubscribed or there's a lot of interest, and then there was not oversubscribed and there's not a lot of interest, right? I think part of the problem with Latitude might be it is the fifth largest lender, as you said. They, you know, they lend for things like you want to buy a, you know, Mac computer, use you know, Latitude. Maybe you want to buy like Harvey Norman furniture, you use Latitude. Now, Latitude actually, and you know, they decided to have got a buy now, pay later type of, you know, pay for 10 weeks or 10 installments, no interest. Now, I think the interesting thing here is that there's a lot of fine print. There's no interest, that's true, but there's a lot of fees, right? There's monthly fees in some cases. There's like, you know, one-off fees in some cases. So that's one aspect. So maybe the growth is not as expected, maybe from, you know, sort of the buy now, pay later sector, which has been like growing fast. The second thing to keep in mind is that there's a lot, you know, again, there's not enough hard collateral, I guess, for all the debt that you would bring with, you know, these type of credit card loans, right?
Right, okay.
I mean, how does that work? I mean, you know, it's one thing to price the bank, which have like a sort of a hard collateral in terms of, okay, there's a property there with some bricks and some land. But, you know, how do you deal that with that furniture? I mean, that furniture, once it has been taken, it's pretty much worth
20%
of the price, right? So that, I think, finally, I think the other thing is that, you know, I feel for the guys trying to do the IPO, I like the fact that the market is not being overly exuberant and is being somewhat cautious in terms of deciding whether or not, you know, they want to pay up for companies.
Right? Yeah, right.
And that, in a way, is a good thing. In an environment where there's a lot of, you know, cash slushing around because of low interest rates and things like that. Yeah. So, I mean, those are my thoughts on this.
It's funny though, Matt. I kind of agree. Well, I do entirely agree with your point that, you know, you never want to see investors overpaying for stuff, because that just kind of indicates that markets are getting a bit frothy and not very good. And, you know, I guess if you're a doomsayer, you want to see the markets crash, so you can be right. But for the rest of us, we're trying to make some money here. So slow and steady does win the race in investing, at least. That being said, I mean, there's also no hesitancy to pay up for some companies, particularly tech, fintech. We've talked about the previously high price of WiseTech. It'll still be, frankly, reasonably richly valued on traditional metrics even after this fall. It feels a little bit like the market's, to use a fancy word, bifurcating. There seems to be two kind of paths right now. There's either really cheap or really expensive. There's either the true believers or the kind of, you know, wall of worry where we're worried about the market. We don't know what's coming next. I mean, at one level, if you're paying, I mean, you know, ProMedicus is, I think, 160 times earnings or something, I think, last time I looked at it. And yet you can't get Latitude away at 12 times earnings. Are there two different types of investors out there? Are there two different types of markets? Are there two different types of companies? I mean, everything's got its price at some level, right? You and I wouldn't necessarily always buy the same companies or pay the same prices. But, you know, we kind of both recognize that even if we're not, someone else is happy to for legitimate reasons. It just strikes me as, I mean, straight out surprising. But even if Latitude, you know, 12 times isn't that expensive, even if the asset quality is slightly less than a bank, even if, you know, assuming it's a reasonably well-run bank, it's not going to go broke anytime soon, and maybe it is, it's not a bank, a finance company, assuming it's not going to go broke anytime soon, there's a price you'd pay, right? And I'm still a little bit surprised there weren't enough investors at that end of the market for that sort of company to pay that sort of price when there are other investors paying triple-digit PEs.
Yeah, so I mean, one interesting thing, dynamic here might be that, you know, given the low interest rate environment, right? I mean, technically, it must be easier to actually find money to lend out, and then basically charge essentially a nice margin on that, right? At the same time, right? I mean, it's a company that's going to be very heavily tied to the economy, right? And it's going to be heavily tied to, so it's going to be cyclical in that sense. Maybe people are feeling, well, you know, 30 years, no recession. You know, how is this company going to behave at, during a recession? Mm. You know, are you paying 12 times of earnings of the, you know, maybe the top or close to the top versus paying 12 times of normalized? It's, again, I think those are sort of the questions. Again, depends on the level of debt they've got. What's their growth runway? How are they going to be competing with the other categories, you know, buy now, pay later, and all the other, you know, sort of things? They're also competing with the banks. If the growth is not going to be that substantial, why wouldn't you buy, if you want to buy a bank and maybe earn some dividends, why wouldn't you buy, you know, Westpac or CBA versus, you know, at 14 or 15 or whatever it is versus buying something at 12?
Yeah, okay.
I think those are the questions. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, again, 12, I would say the 12 times sounds reasonable, but maybe not necessarily cheap. It depends on what the growth runway is, right? Yeah, I mean, if the growth runway is there, then 12 times is like cheap. But I my suspicion would be that probably the growth is questionable.
I think you're probably right, but I don't know if you're an investor in that into the market, you own bank shares, for example, 15 times. Why you wouldn't want to own some Latitude as well instead, diversify something at 12 times? We'll know in the fullness of time, right? Maybe this was a great IPO to miss out on. Maybe the company goes broke in 3 years' time. Maybe it's just a really, really horribly risky business that is simply not, you know, justified by the price.
So here's maybe a question, right? How much is the, you know, it's a rough take, just came to my mind right now, which is always risky when something comes to your mind. How much is the PE of something like Bank of Queensland, right? Maybe that's probably a more reasonable compare, right? Mm. I mean, something like a regional bank with sort of a lender, which is maybe the fifth largest lender, but in a different category. And maybe that's what we expect. Like, I mean, you know, Bank of Queensland has had some difficulties of late. Earnings are shrinking, going backwards. Yeah. So maybe that's the sort of fear that if you're not a big four, then you don't have enough market clout to, you know, like,
possibly.
You know, I don't know how much Bank of Queensland is, but.
So you talk long enough, mate, to give me enough time to log into my brokerage account and check. So 12.9 times earnings.
Yeah. So if it's like, you know, Bank of Queensland is at 12 times with, you know, earnings going backwards, maybe this 12 times is just about fair value without knowing much. I don't know. I don't know.
Look, I'm not rushing. I'm not saying people should have bought Latitude. I haven't looked at the IPO documents. Funnily enough, I wasn't invited to participate. I'm all for people saying too hard, walk away, don't know, all that kind of good stuff. I just feel like I haven't seen the financials. If it's a decently run business, even in the financial space, 12 times earnings. I mean, you've got to assume a bit goes wrong. Relative, even just on a relative basis, compared to say CommSec at 16, right? Like, think about the mortgage exposure, everything else. Is it really that much worse to be selling for, I don't know, 20% less on a PE basis? It's not even a question of either or. It's like, well, if you've got a portfolio full of CommSec, wouldn't you want to add a little bit of Latitude and sell some CommSec to do it? Or bank or CommSec? I don't know. Maybe it's in the whole thing. It struck me as unusual. That it wasn't an overly demanding price, given generally an appetite for these sorts of businesses on the ASX.
Captain, you know what you should do?
Tell me.
Should send a tweet out to the CEO and the PE people.
Yes.
Saying that you are happy to pay, 11 times or 11 and a half times.
There you go.
And just buy the whole business.
Deal. Easy. I'll put it on the credit card.
Yeah.
I'll use a Latitude buy now, pay later option.
Yeah, use a Latitude credit card and buy some stock. Just buy the whole thing.
Pay it off over the next 5 years, interest free.
Yeah.
All right. Mate, shall we get onto the mailbag?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. So I'm pretty excited. We've had a couple of Insta questions again this week, and I'm new to Instagram. I've got about, I think, 3 followers or something. So we are on all the socials. I'll take the opportunity now. If you're thinking about getting in contact with us, please do. You can get us on Twitter. Doc is at Anirban Mahanti. I'm at Scott, TMF Scott P. TMF Scott P. Or The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. Hit us up on Twitter. Ask us a question. Leave us a comment. Give us some feedback. You can, of course, use Instagram, as I just mentioned, at The Motley Fool AU again, or at TMF Scott P. Doc is yet to make his Insta debut.
I'm not making an Instagram.
Never say never.
I'm off any Facebook property. Yeah.
Until Facebook owns the world, and you're forced to, mate.
Until Facebook is broken up, I am so not going to be on those Facebook properties.
Or if you are on Facebook, I am, and you can too. You can hit us up. The Motley Fool Australia is our Facebook company page, or I'm Scott Phillips Money is my kind of page as opposed to my personal account, because as much as I love our listeners, you don't want to see my family photos, trust me, and I don't want to see yours. So my page as opposed to my kind of profile is Scott Phillips Money. So hit me up there. All right, mates, let's get into the mailbag. The first, as I said, Insta question, as I inferred, came from Alex. As the underscore 1168 is his Instagram handle. I think they call them handles, don't they? I can't keep up with the cool kids, mate.
It's handles.
All right. So this is one especially for you, mate. Alex says, "Hey guys, loving the podcast. Such a great listen on my drive to and from work each day." Excellent, Alex. Thank you. He says, "Keen to get your thoughts on cybersecurity shares on the ASX. Do you have any thoughts? They all seem to be micro caps. Would you recommend an ETF instead? Cheers, guys, and hashtag full on." I love the hashtag.
That's I love cool. the hashtag too.
Hashtag full on. Doc, I'm going to pump this straight to you, because my answer is I've got no bloody idea. So I'm not going to help Alex at all on this one, not because I don't want to, just because I can't. And we are in the very fortunate position, mate. Unlike almost all of our peers, we get to say, "I don't know," without any ramifications for our company or our careers. So I don't know anything about cybersecurity shares on the ASX, but I imagine you might.
I know a little bit. So Alex made, I think, great observation first to say that a lot of those stocks that he has found are microcaps. Sure, some microcaps can be great, but some microcaps can be really dangerous because they're microcaps. It basically means they're small, really tiny companies with tiny revenues, if they have revenues, and you know, and they could potentially at some point go bust if things don't work out. It's great to know that that's the case, because then you can choose accordingly. There aren't actually, cybersecurity is not a hot, I mean, it's a hot area overall, but there aren't many companies on the ASX that actually do, I'd say, you know, that are pure plays in cybersecurity. We have a pretty good space in SaaS. Mm. We have got, fintech, a lot of fintech stuff, but cybersecurity is not stuff that we actually are, you know, it's not something that we have.
I know, because you're avoiding it as a sector just because you haven't found any investable ideas.
When I say there aren't, there are not enough companies of worthy companies that I've, at least I have found.
Right.
There are lots of small companies again, yeah, which you know, over time could bubble up. So that's number one.
And some may well do well. You just don't have enough confidence just yet to put your money behind it.
Yeah, exactly. So we haven't actually on Extreme Opportunities too. We haven't really recommended anything in the cybersecurity space. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of SaaS type of companies on in the tech space there. In terms of ideas, ETFs, yeah. So there are a couple of ETFs I think that you can find which cover the cybersecurity space. These are mostly ETFs that give you exposure to international stocks. It could be good for diversification. There's one called HACK,
that's the code, right? HACK.
That's the code. It's the cybersecurity. I just love it because it almost sounds hack. Sounds like the name. It should be called the HACK ETF, because it's the anti-hack ETF.
Right.
Yeah, right. So, so it's the cybersecurity ETF.
Right.
It's got a long name, but that. We've recommended that.
And that's US companies or Australian companies? I can't remember.
So that's basically, I think, US listed companies.
Right.
Most of them, it's not, I would not call it a pure play cybersecurity in the sense that they have got other, some networking companies and so on included in it, which are not really 100% pure play cybersecurity, but they have got a cybersecurity interest. Like, I think they own, for example, Cisco,
which has got
a cybersecurity interest, but it's not really a cybersecurity pure play. That's a good ETF to own because it's diversified. It gives you exposure to some of the cybersecurity space, gives you exposure to a lot of different companies. We, as I said, we own it in the Motley Fool Pro. That's one that I think people can look at. In the micro cap space, you just got to look and know what you're looking at and then decide.
Beautiful. Well done, mate. And good question, Alex. Obviously a very good question, because Doc's already thinking along those lines. Cybersecurity is going to be a much bigger issue over our lifetimes, I'm sure. And the HACK ETF may well be one way to play it. Mates, last question for now, because we're coming up on 53-odd minutes, and frankly, while we started this as a short podcast, it always gets longer, but we'll try and keep it short. Well, not make it any longer anyway, put it that way. Question from Zach. I love this question to finish us off, mate. I would love it more, except it gives you some praise, so I don't love necessarily...
Sometimes some people are going to praise me, too. Like, I know.
I just rather I get the credit, mate, frankly, around here.
Oh, you get it the most of the time anyways.
No, I don't. I was accused of waffling last week.
You're the chief investment officer, right? Everything that's right...
I get all the reflected glory. Is that what you're saying? Well,
everything that's right is all your credit. And all the rubbish that happens is basically our problem, right?
I'm tempted on your tacit approval to reword the question, but I won't. Zach says, hey, Scott, I'm up 90% on Megaport. In brackets, big thanks to Doc. Well done, mate. Congratulations. And I'm sure your other members thank you as well. But he says, should I add to this position at this price? Or should I wait? How can I know when to top up on my winners versus buying a new stock? I love this for lots of different reasons about Megaport. I love the question about adding to winners. I love the question about where to put new money. So a really, really good combination. And that's a really big question for a lot of people, mate, is, you know, there's two groups of people, right? This group of people say, the stock's already up. I've missed my chance. Or they'll say, the stock's down. I'm not going to buy it when it's down. I'll wait till it goes up. And often those are the same people. It's very easy to psych ourselves out of investing, right? Either we don't want to buy, you know, we should have all been buying at the bottom of the GFC, but everyone didn't because they were scared. We should have all been, you know, arguably selling after Amazon doubled, then tripled, then doubled, then tripled, then doubled, then tripled again, but we didn't because it was up so much. Or Apple, I'll throw one of yours at you because I've mentioned Amazon a dozen times already. And yet in either and both cases, you know, it was always, you should have been buying at the bottom of the GFC and you should have been buying at almost every historical high price for Amazon or Apple shares just because, you know, the shares kept largely going up. So in that case, because they would buy anything anytime, of course, the market's also littered with plenty of stocks that flew high and then came off their highs, never to retrace them or spend a long time. And maybe Microsoft is a great example. It took 15 years to regain its dot-com crash highs or pre-dot-com crash highs. So, you know, there's no easy answer to this one. Hence, I think, Zach's question. So Megaport, great result. You can talk about Megaport if you want, but I'm far more interested to know, because I'll give you the credit for Megaport, how should someone know whether to add to a winner or wait or buy something else?
Yeah, so I'll just quickly add on Megaport. So, you know, Megaport... two of our colleagues actually have egged me to look at Megaport. So Andrew Leggett actually, first mentioned it to me when it was actually a really small company. And then Kevin Gandia later on again mentioned to me, like, you know, we should look at this company. So that's how I actually got recommended.
Mate,
so
remember though, you've just said I get all the credit for this. Don't give so much credit away, mate. So they're okay. But, yeah, you know.
Sometimes you got to give... you know, pass some credit to the other guys too, right?
We do. Yeah. Andrew and Kevin are great investors, and we're very, very lucky, and our members are very fortunate that they're on our team.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think with specifics to like when to add, so I'll answer it generally in generic and then, you know, quickly comment on Megaport. Beautiful. So in general, if I buy something, I would buy what I call, especially for higher risk stocks, I generally, if I like it, I buy a startup position. Like, you know, startup position varies from people. It's really a personal preference thing. For me, it's anywhere between a 1% and 2% allocation to my portfolio.
Right.
For some, it might be more.
So if you've got a $100 million portfolio, you're putting $1 or $2 million behind it. Is that what you're
saying? Captain, I don't have. if I had a $100 million portfolio, maybe I wouldn't be here.
You'd be here.
I'd still be here. but I don't have
to. You say 1 or 2% of your portfolio, whatever that is,
yeah,
and you're putting that in, as a startup position into your new stock.
I'm just going to clarify, I don't have $100 million. you know, not even close. so with that said, okay, so that's not. So I started the startup position. Then Zach's question, man, this is brilliant. When do you add? This, again, I think is a very personal thing, right? It's a personal thing because I prefer to add when I have more confidence in the business. And by that, I basically mean there's been good execution. So in terms of a company, there's been more customers, more revenue. Okay. Their dominance is growing, yet they still have a long runway for growth.
So it's kind of justifying your faith. By delivering business performance, you kind of like, well, I kind of hope they'd keep doing well, and they are. So I kind of feel like my thesis is playing out somewhat.
Exactly. And of course, price is a consideration. Now, if I'm looking at companies that have, you know, multi-bagger potential, then I'm easy on the price. I'm not saying that I'll pay any price, but I'm easy on the price. I'm not going to quibble over, you know, a few cents, a few percentages up and down. I'm going to be okay with that. Now, in this, often what happens is when a company is actually succeeding, the price goes up, which basically means you're going, you know, you're typically buying on the way up.
Right. And that's hard, man.
That's really hard.
I got to say, even you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've managed to overcome mostly my aversion for paying higher prices, and some of our re-recommendations of higher price stocks have done pretty well. But I still, even for our services or for me personally, I still look at a price and go, well, I kind of like it at 10, but gee, it would have been nice to get it at 5 or 7 yeah. or 8. And I mean, it's gone up so much now. Is there really enough left? And I'm not so sure. Like, it's still a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
For me anyway.
Yeah. And then the question he's asking is, should I add to my winner versus, you know, add buy a new stock? Again, right. This is really a question about how much do you want to put in one company and how big your portfolio want to be. And again, there's no real easy answer in the sense that, you know, like, do you want to own 50 stocks? Do you want to own 30? Somewhere between 15 and 30 probably gives you the amount of diversification that you need. It again, I think you need to factor in the risk level of your company. So if your companies have higher risk, then I think you want to own more. So if you own like extreme opportunity style companies, then I would say that, you know, 15 is too less. You probably want way more than that because there is a chance that you're going to lose, you know, money on more than say you would say if you own more of them than you would say from ShareAdvisor, largely because of the type of companies and the sort of they're early in the stage of evolution that they are.
So to play that out a little bit, just to clarify that, because it's a really important point. What you're saying is there's going to be hopefully a few companies in that group that do really, really well, and a decently large number, a minority, but a decently large number who'll do poorly to one degree or other, because there's such early stage companies that the ones who win will win hugely. The ones that don't win may well crash and burn, lose decent amounts of money, or just simply go nowhere. And so the reality is you don't know which is which, and the wider the range of outcomes, the more you want, so you don't accidentally buy the wrong small number. You're better off having a large number of possibles than a small number who may or may not. Like if the small number goes really, really well, you're a genius. But the small number, you know, if you have 20 out of 50 that don't go anywhere, if you only buy 5 or 6 stocks, there's a very good chance you're going to have 3, 4, or 5 of those 20 in that group.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. So that's correct. So no. Then with respect to this particular stock, and in respect to our service, we recently, not too long ago, started this Best Buys Now feature, which basically gives people an idea of which sort of, you know, 3 stocks we think that you could, you know, from among the existing recommendations that, you know, you can have a look at to add if you're looking to add. And most of the time, we're actually looking at business performance and then, you know, looking at a price. We've actually not put Megaport on a BBN yet.
A
Best Buys Now.
Right.
Yet. Now, I'll clarify that. So I think the company's execution has been really, really solid. And their North America execution has actually been really, really good. The problem with that has been that the market has also realized that their North America execution has actually been really, really good, which is why he's sitting on 90% gains. I think we have a double on that stock on our scorecard.
Well done.
But that's basically, I think the price, it's some of that has actually been priced in. So what I mean is effectively, if you own the stock, continue owning it. If you don't actually own a position, I think, you know, you can effectively open a position, and we're happy we have left it as a buy. I wouldn't overweight it yet. We haven't done a double rec, for example, for that reason, is that it there are still, you know, it's still a company that's burning money,
right?
It's growing really, really fast in a very important market, but it's still burning money. And I think the tipping point, I like to see the tipping point happen now at some point when it tips over and it actually becomes profitable and or at least stops burning money. And that's a good point, because again, you know, this is, you know,
so self-sustaining at that point, right?
Self-sustaining. Like SDNs, so which is software defined networking, and which is basically elastic bandwidth, which these guys, this is a hugely important area. It's one of the few, you know, public companies that's doing this and doing it really, really in a nice way. They've got a really good team. So they've got a lot of things in the checkbox. They've raised capital a number of times. It's, again, those were good points to when they're, you know, raising capitals. You could actually participate in the capital, the capital infusion.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And at least not diluted your stake and probably got in at a good price. So I think that's what I would say with this particular company. So I would not overweight it. I'd stay with my allocation. If I didn't own it, I would be happy to own some. I'm looking for a turning point sort of thing in this particular investment case.
Mate, for those listeners who've stuck with us for the hour, that I think is probably the most interesting and useful piece of information we've given, despite my wonderful rants earlier on. Mate, so thank you for that. I think if you are an investor who's just starting out, or if you've been investing for a little while, rewind 5-10 minutes, whatever, however far you need to go back. Have another listen to what Doc just said. That's a really, really smart way to think about the psychology of investing, but also the specifics, the things you need to be aware of, the things you should be paying attention to, particularly for early stage companies, when you're trying to evaluate the risk and potential return. Yes, you're giving a bit of a return if you wait a bit longer, but you may well be reducing the risk meaningfully, and that might just see your portfolio tip from a good return into potentially a great one. So well done, Doc. That's excellent. Guys, that wraps us up. We've made it.
We made it.
But before we go,
made it or they made it?
Well, well, we've definitely made it because we're almost finished. So we're finished now. Can't quite go and have a beer yet. It's still morning, but yeah, we'll might go have lunch somewhere. But if you're listening this far, you have also made it. Well done. And thank you, as always, for listening. By now, you probably know you can subscribe, and we think you should, to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, and why wouldn't you? And frankly, if you're stuck with us for the last hour, you probably do. Please give us a rating on iTunes. Leave us a review. Tell your friends. We're sure they could use a little foolish straight talk too. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.